It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And indeed we are. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Good to see you, Captain Mike.
Good to see you, Sean, always.
And it is a lot to talk about on today's show. It's, getting here, that transitional period. Yeah. There's going to be some hunting discussion on today's show, but there's plenty of fishing to talk about as well. And we'll do that right now as we get started, as always, with our fishing report live from the headquarters at J&M Tackle in South Baldwin County. Chris Vesche joining us to talk about, fish. Hey, Chris.
Hey, what's happening?
Man, fishing was happening on the brain. A lot of talk about what's been going on offshore, near shore, and inshore. So what about it, the world headquarters there at J&M? What are you hearing this last week, offshore fishing? What's the blue water been? I say blue water. Offshore.
Yeah.
You might say
last week was the white marlin shootout, and there was well over 200 billfish caught.
Wow. Very
good bite through the week. Slowed down a little bit towards the weekend when we came up on the neap tide. But as far as during the week goes, the numbers of white marlin sailfish are really high. Quite a few blue marlin caught, a lot of swordfish. That was
how many, again, I got to stop and come back here. How many billfish were caught during it?
I'd have to look at the exact numbers. I want to say it was like 210 billfish caught
that is,
for the week.
To me, and not, I'm not a guy that spent my whole life billfishing. It's kind of a rare thing for me, but that blows me away. That's a heck of a number.
Yeah, it's a lot of. I'm trying to remember how many boats total. The way they format the tournament is it's 6 days of fishing, but you can pick 3 days. So you don't fish all 6 days. You pick the 3 days, and then you go. So that was the total from pretty much from the week, which is pretty solid numbers for sure. But it did slow down. The water was not blue for sure. Where most guys are fishing is just kind of a clean green, but lots of bait, lots of life in general. Some big dolphin caught, some open water tunas and things. Tuna bite was a little slow last week. Bottom fishing was good. Pretty much everything's good. Now the red snapper bite was definitely getting tough as we're getting into, the later part of the season. But, in general, the bite was very solid last week.
What are you helping people down there do if they're trying to get, there's still fish out there. We're talking about red snapper, mm-hmm. But you got maybe what you're, if you're dropping squid on a chicken rig in the beginning of the season, it's not working anymore.
Yeah.
Kind of, what do you tell people? Somebody walks in the shop and says, man, I'm marking up fish. I'm marking up fish. Help me catch them. What do you do?
You have to adjust your tactics. A lot of people don't. A lot of people just go out there fishing the same stuff, same, whether it be frozen baits or even to a degree some live baits. Like, it's all the difference of your prep and the quality of bait. So, for example, putting a pinfish trap out because it's easy versus stopping and getting, small hardtails or LYs or something at the pass, which are far superior baits. Taking the time to catch a bonita or two and use like fresh, strips or chunks of bonita. That's one thing about big snappers. If I'm fishing heavily pressured, fish, a lot of time fresh cut bait, that red meat on a bonita is just hard to beat. We pretty much always do get on that. And even ladyfish, last week I was able to catch a few keeper red snapper at the jetties, using fresh cut ladyfish.
I say what?
So,
yeah. I say, oh,
oh yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. How about that?
The jetties? I like that.
Yes, sir. Now that's not always to be expected, but I mean, it's one of those things that, taking the time to try some different baits, different approaches, scaling down your tackle, going from your 60-pound, heavy leaders to longer 30-pound leader, that's what makes a difference a lot of time.
What are you running on, and so listen to what Chris is saying. Y'all scale down on leader, on your fluorocarbon. Are you running knocker rigs, or what are you running?
Mostly knockers, or even if you're in shallow enough water, freeline it. Freeline mm-hmm. the bait through the water column. But a lot of time knockers. Now, I fish very, very lightweights on my knocker rigs. I'm fishing a quarter to half ounce, sometimes three quarters. I don't like going above three quarters on my knockers. I'm usually fishing them on a spinning rod. That way I can let that thing just slowly work its way down through the column versus bombing it to the bottom. Like, even if I go up to 1 ounce or ounce and a half, that's significantly heavier and it takes the bait down a lot faster. I want that bait to slowly work through the column.
That's smart.
Yeah, good.
Now,
good
at
tip.
The jetties, are you targeting snapper or are you just catching snapper as you're targeting?
I was more or less hopeful for it, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, start out the morning catching a few ladyfish right there around the islands and then work your way out. And, you know, you find out real quick when you're fishing those bigger baits, you fish them down there, you know, around those outer rocks of the jetties. You know, you give it a little bit of time. You find out pretty quick if those fish are there and if they're game for it. You know, and you can always drop shrimp and other stuff to catch kind of the whole smorgasbord of what's there. Everything eats a shrimp, including those snapper. But when you put down a big slab of that ladyfish, you're going to find out if those bigger fish are there.
I love it. Let's talk about back inshore. How's inshore fishing been?
It's getting better for sure. I fish a little bit more inshore here lately. I fished this morning. This morning, me and a buddy caught some really solid specks, up to probably 23 inches or so.
Good.
We had really good action with big redfish. There's a lot of blues in that shallow water, which I went to heavier leader. I was fishing 40-pound leader this morning, and it didn't matter. Still getting hits from the trout and stuff.
And still getting
because
cut off, probably.
you still could. That's the thing. But if I go up to 40, I can take a shot or two from those bluefish and not lose my lure. If I stick with that 20-pound, there's a very good chance I'm going to lose some tackle. So if I go up to 40-pound, and honestly, if I'm throwing topwater, I fish 40-pound mono, not fluorocarbon.
Because you want the stretch?
You want the stretch, but you also don't want the sink rate of that fluorocarbon. It'll actually pull the nose of that topwater down a little bit. So
another great
usually
tip.
Fish that 40 fluoro.
That's a great tip. I never thought about that.
Oh, 100% makes a bit. Next time you're out fishing, tie on a, you know, 2 to 3 feet foot piece of fluorocarbon and throw a topwater on it, and then throw the same lure on a 2 or 3 foot piece of mono. The lure on the mono works far easier because the mono doesn't sink.
That's a great tip. I mean, because I'm thinking about all my rods like that. It's, you know, braid, uni knot, enda, depending on what I'm doing, but yep. It's fluorocarbon. I don't know if it's 20 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought about that, keeping the nose down.
I didn't realize that.
See, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, people, listen, people can get an education and get the gear to go catch them. Tell them how to find you at J&M.
They can find us here on Canal Road, just past the wharf, about a mile and a half. You can call us here at the store at 251-981-5460. And we're here to talk fishing. Come by and see us.
Good stuff. We'll talk to you next week. Chris, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, and coming up in just a second, we're shifting gears. Dove season around the corner. So's teal season. Cole Howard, migratory game bird coordinator for Alabama, joins us next. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have you along. And like I said, it's a transition season. Talked just a little bit there, a few minutes on fishing, which is still strong.
Yep.
But folks like me that love to hunt the birds, I mean, this is the time of year. It's getting there. I mean, it's just right around the corner.
Dove season opens up, what, two weeks?
Well, North Zone on the 5th, and then the 12th will be us here in the South Zone. Actually, we don't just have to guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could just go do this. I would get y'all the official word. Cole Howard, migratory game bird coordinator for the state of Alabama, joining us now. Thanks for being on. Hey, Cole, you there?
Yeah.
There
hey,
he is.
Sean, how are you?
Good. No, Mike and I were just talking about, how close hunting migratory birds is. I mean, a couple weeks here, North Zone doves going to be open, and the next week, South Zone doves. I mean, it's here. Even though it's August, I mean, it's just about to be here.
Yeah, it's exciting. Things are finally are picking back up, even though it's still hot outside. You know, fall's coming. We're getting all of our youth dove hunts squared away. WMA managers are getting their fields ready, starting to burn some dove fields off, getting seed on the ground for dove. So, yeah, it's exciting. Time to go, shoot some clays and get ready.
No, but here's the thing, though. If you go shoot clays, then that takes away the excuse. So you get out there and say, well, something's wrong with this gun from last year. I don't know. I don't have any problem, but there's something's wrong. It's the gun malfunctioning. It's not the fact that I can't shoot.
Yeah, I mean, I normally I'm 50-50 either way. You know, some days shoot the lights out, some days it's trash. That is good to hear.
That you're like you have that. Me too. There have been and I don't know what it is. If I could recreate it, there'll be a day out there where I can't miss a dove. I kill three while I'm walking with my bucket to sit down, and I'm done fast. Like, oh, it's over. Okay. And some days I'm like, I'm going to throw this gun away. I'm going to the store and buy another shotgun. I hate this gun.
Sean, I am never that way. I am always consistent. I miss them every time. And listen, I'm curious, what does the state do to get ready for dove season? What do they plant? When do they start planting? What does the state do? And you said they were putting out seed.
Burning millet and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So, tell me what the state does to get ready for dove season.
Yeah, I mean, each individual WMA manager is going to have their preferences on what they like to plant, how they like to manage their fields, and that might vary too from the south end of the state to the north end. But I mean, largely it's going to be you plant your millet, sunflower, Really, those are kind of our main two, disking, sowing, top sowing winter wheat, and making sure those crops are in the ground in time in the spring, and then keeping weeds out of them during the summer, and then start doing some manipulation, burning them off, making sure, dove, they don't have real strong legs, so they're like bare soil on the ground and underneath some of that vegetation, so they can really get at those seeds that were grown and put on the ground. And so those are just some of the prep things in terms of getting the ground ready and making those seeds that have been grown available for the doves to get to.
I've been mowing millet for a couple of weeks, just started mowing sunflowers just last week on one of my fields. But you mentioned topsow. So we do this every year and talk about it, and your predecessor had to deal with this. So not that we have to get into every detail here, but let's go to it. Somebody's going to top sow wheat on a field. What's legal? When can they do it? And how much can they do? And what about the prep?
Yeah, so I would say always check with our state ag extension. They're the ones that kind of lay out what is considered a normal agricultural practice. And the major thing to keep in mind when, thinking about, is this going to be legal topsowing, is, the intent of the law is that what you're doing is a normal agricultural practice and you're not just out there baiting doves, essentially. And so you need to prepare the soil and prepare the field as if you want that seed to grow and you want it to be a successful planting for winter wheat as a crop. And so just keeping that in mind, typically you need to have, consult the Ag Extension. If you have any questions, call your local game warden and get things fleshed out there. But I'm going to leave it at generally just the intent of the law is that you follow normal agricultural practice, make sure your seed bed's prepared. You can't be doing it, topsowing multiple times throughout the season. It's not like, oh, I can do that over and over again to just keep putting out more and more seed. And,
The prep, the soil prep. Like you said, I think the best axiom here, the best thing is always to call your local warden, have them check it, but you wouldn't plant wheat on something that had a bunch of dirt clods the size of softballs in it.
No.
I mean, if you're going to make a crop, you're going to have that a real fine layer.
And you'd want that for dove anyway.
You want it for dove. Yeah, it absolutely does it for dove, but that you have to go through that, and I don't want to step on something that I shouldn't call, but I mean, that's how I understand it. I mean, I prep it. Yeah. I mean, I prep it like I'm trying to make a wheat crop.
Exactly. 100%. And if you do that, you'll be fine.
And the game warden probably wouldn't like it if you were planting 1,000 pounds per acre either of wheat seed. So you need to find out what the right poundage of wheat per acre you need to plant.
Yes, and per our ag extension is 200 pounds an acre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's your number. The nice thing for all of us is it comes in bags that have a weight on them, so you know what you planted. So, Onyx your acreage and make sure you're on that. Okay, I know I've drifted off into the enforcement side, and let's talk about the other side of this and the biologist side where you are. Let's talk about populations and how we're looking, Cole. I mean, there's a long-term discussion of people saying, where are the doves? We don't have the doves we used to. And then some places say, hey, it's as good as it's ever been. What's the research show? How are we doing? What morning dove population?
Yeah, I mean, we're still sitting strong as far as our morning dove population. I mean, we're in a liberal bag limits in terms of our federal framework. So Alabama falls in what's known as the Eastern Management Unit for our dove population management, and we're sitting about 80 million doves in the Eastern Management Unit right now. Alabama, we're harvesting over a million, pushing a million and a half doves every single year. So that's something not short of supply.
That's pretty strong. So that's, I didn't know that was a number. That's
80 million is a lot, and you only harvest a million and a half. But they
don't, like, what's lifespan for a morning dove? How long, like a, I mean, obviously, someone that was kept in a zoo or something, but I'm talking about in the wild. What do we expect?
Yeah, they're pretty short lived. They're really not going to live more than a couple years, and many of the juveniles won't make it out of their first year.
So, if you say, man, I'm shooting an old dove, is how old of a dove?
2-3 year old bird is pretty old. Anything over 3, like that's an old bird.
So they're cycling over.
I mean, I didn't realize that. I thought they'd get a little bit older than that. 4 years
live
old,
fast,
or
die young,
five or something. Yeah, I mean they got to reproduce pretty heavy to keep that many doves going.
Yeah, and dove would be what we would consider in the biology world as an R selected species. So they reproduce young, and they produce a lot of young. And that's kind of why, part of the reason why we're able to harvest so many, and they will replenish themselves.
Now, then the age-old question. So migratory versus non-migratory, this time of year, young doves versus, first-of-the-year doves. What are we shooting? If you're north zone, coming up, or south zone, we're out there opening day. Those local production, or if we got migrating doves, how many migrating doves ever make it to the state? Kind of break that down for us.
Yeah, that's a great question. So dove are migratory species. We do get migrants coming in from other states, but primarily we're mostly harvesting doves that are raised here in Alabama. Our state agency, we put out about 1,000 bands a year across the state on mourning doves, and that's to feed into these larger scale population models and looking at harvest rate and survival rates to make sure that we are, sustainably harvesting for the long term. And almost 98% of our band returns that we have of our birds that are banded in Alabama are harvested here in Alabama. So we're primarily shooting our own birds.
Okay. And I've got a follow-on question that probably ask that when we come back from the break, because I wonder on the management side. But once again, too, limits, people, of course, all this is outdoor Alabama, but somebody listening right now, north zone, south zone, what limits the same? What's the limit?
Yep. Yeah, 15 a day, possession limits 45. Okay. 3 times the daily bag limit.
So, and does that include white wings in that bag limit?
That's an aggregate. So
the white wings, I've had this discussion with folks. The white wings count against your 15, y'all.
Yeah.
Because people say, no, I got 15 mornings, and then I get nine. I said, go ask a game warden. Not the way I understand it.
Maybe he don't want to ask a game warden.
Yeah, probably right. All right, coming back, more with Cole Howard. He's a migratory bird coordinator with State of Alabama, and we'll do more questions. I'm going to ask a question about how you make more doves, habitat management, when we come back. Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have y'all along. Great conversation on the air and during the news breaks with Cole Howard. He's a migratory game bird coordinator for the state of Alabama. Right now, talking about doves. We will talk some waterfowl as well. But yeah, to wrap up on the dove side here, you're talking about, you know, we're shooting our own this time of year as we come into season. But if somebody wanted to produce more doves, you know, I mean, there's all kind of people know, okay, I got that brooding habitat for turkeys and quail, you know, and nesting habitat. I got to do this to have better deer recruitment, whatever it is. What is there something you do to try to make more doves? Is there a habitat that they like to make babies in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, yeah, I'd say just kind of think about everything a dove needs in a day. And if you can provide that on your property, you know, do they have good roosting and loafing trees, you know, power lines to sit on? Do they have bare soil and grit they can get to? Is there seed available during that time? Are there water sources on your property or nearby? And so kind of, you know, thinking of a dove field, you know, we're thinking of primarily providing food, which is one of the components, but kind of holistically think about, you know, what that dove might need in a day or throughout the breeding period, and not just one of those components.
Is there a certain tree that they like to roost in, or do they roost in?
Yeah, I know oak trees, I know the species trees? Dead.
Do what now?
Yeah,
the species they like to roost in is dead. But I don't know, Cole. What do you think?
That's a great question. And if they do have a preferred tree species, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah. Well, I've seen lots of nests in the pine trees, and I didn't know whether that was their preferred.
Oh, for nesting, yeah.
I mean, for nesting. Yeah,
okay, I thought you were talking about for roosting in, but yeah, nesting. Yeah, what is, I mean, do they want something that's real brushy or something that's open? Or?
You know, like any kind of species that's probably preyed upon by, you know, birds of prey and other things like that, they're going to need cover for their nest and good nesting material. But that being said, we kind of see dove in a lot of different places. That's kind of why they do so well across most of the eastern U.S.
Now, let's talk about their range now. Not talking about the migratory, well, the local migratory range. What do you, I mean, is there any research out that says when doves come flying over, you know, opening day afternoon, and I know we're hunting our locals, but do those locals come in from 100 yards away, or do they come in from, how far will a dove travel from where it roosts to come in, you know, to a field? Is it measured in miles, tens of miles? What do you think?
That's a really good question. And, I hate to use like a cop-out answer of like that it's going to depend.
It's like every biologist. Yeah. It depends. I love it though. You're consistent. I love that.
But, you know, a lot of our bands get harvested relatively close to where they're put out. So within typically a couple mile radius.
Okay. So if you see, you know, if you, there's, because your, if your neighbor has doves, that's good. Those doves, even if that neighbor half mile away or something like that, or a quarter mile away, those could very well be coming on to you later on.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
That's good. Now, what about ringnecks? Let's talk about ringnecks real quick. Are they, tell us about ringnecks, and they don't count for your limit, right?
Oh, you're talking about
collared doves.
Collared doves, ringneck doves.
I have to translate. Dove. I have to translate, Mike.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I thought you were talking about ringneck ducks.
Yeah, or like, ringneck doves.
We could go over there too. Eurasian collared doves are an invasive species and not native to Alabama.
So they don't count.
No, sir.
Yeah.
Just like a pigeon, Mike.
Yeah. But I do see a lot more of them than I used to. I mean, just about everywhere I go, I think I almost see as many or more collared doves than I do regular morning doves. I mean, I see a lot of them, it seems like.
Are y'all seeing that, Cole? Yeah. You seeing, I mean, around the state, are you seeing that?
I'll be honest. I don't have a great pulse. We don't really have, we don't really band them or monitor them in a huge way. But that is definitely something where any sort of non-native species, we're always going to be interested in keeping an eye out and seeing how that, you know, how they might interact with our native species populations.
Okay, here's my segue, Mike. Okay, so everybody prepare yourself for a segue. While this is not coming, it's not invasive species coming from another continent, but it is a duck species, or species, let me say plural, because we've got more than one, that growing up here as a kid hunting in the 80s, you know, I started duck hunting in the 80s, never saw them, never even heard about them. That's whistling ducks in general.
Yeah.
And that's a thing. Maybe I don't see the numbers here. There's one place in Mobile County I can go see a bunch of them. It's not like being in Louisiana, but we got them here in South Alabama.
Yep. And they're actually, they're spreading up into North Alabama as well. They're covering the state, but definitely a lot more in the southern part of the state. Yeah, kind of across, you know, the Gulf states, even up into Tennessee, Arkansas, some of those more northern states, we're seeing breeding black-bellied whistling ducks, and they've been expanding their range for a while now. It's a really interesting thing going on, and I mean, like this year, even Louisiana just opened a special black-bellied whistling duck season.
So I saw that.
For them.
Is there a number like? What did they have to get to in Louisiana to decide? Yeah, if we can do this special season. Or is there kind of benchmark set there, or would Alabama ever consider something like that?
I'm not saying we wouldn't ever consider something like that. There's a lot of processes that go into opening a new season with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Louisiana has also experienced a major pest problem with black-bellied whistling ducks, and so that was kind of a big push for opening a season. And so if we ever got to that point, it would take quite a bit of, we'd have to have a lot better pulse on our population. And I don't think we're anywhere close to that level. I think it would be a number of years and take quite a bit more buy-in from some of the other states in the flyway would have to get on board with it. And I'm not saying never, but
gotcha.
I wouldn't count. I don't think we should think about it soon.
Gotcha. Okay. What about if they end up in over your decoys? And I know a lot of people say they're all going to be gone, but I've heard people still see them. And that place in Mobile County, they keep them on into December. If you shoot one, you know, during duck season, is it part of your six ducks? Does it count?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So they aren't separate. So with that being said, we're talking about duck numbers. The first thing to come up before we jump to any kind of big duck season is blue-winged teal season. And that's coming up in just, you know, on the 12th, right? So it's just a few weeks away as well.
Yep.
What are you seeing? You seeing anything? You hearing any reports from up on the Tennessee? Any birds showing up yet?
I haven't heard much yet. I've seen a couple reports of some teal showing up. I've saw, you know, some of the northern states had some, you know, the few that have reported numbers from their breeding population surveys had some pretty strong teal numbers. So that's encouraging. But yeah, we'll have to see. I have no reason to think it wouldn't be a good teal season considering some of the water that, you know, Canada and the prairies got later in the year. So, should be an exciting one.
Yeah. I mean, how do you gauge that? So say teal, they don't seem to have that long because they come, you know, I mean, they're heading back to the breeding grounds and then heck, they hadn't been there long before they're coming back down. what water conditions, is it late water that's better for them on the prairies or early? Like what, if you say this is going to benefit teal more than a pintail or a mallard or, you know, pick another species.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say in terms of breeding that, you know, you could gauge that, you know, more so it'd be better for one species like tea or like pintail or mallards, because they kind of fill similar niches. But in terms of like how we manage for them, you know, here in Alabama, I would say, you know, if you've got property or you're looking for places to hunt, you know, a teal is a pretty small duck. I think we all know that. And so look for places with shallower water, especially be thinking about food sources that are covered in like 4 to 6 inches of water versus, you know, our bigger ducks like our mallards, you know, they'll dabble in 12 to 18 inches of water. So those are just some things to be thinking about when you're scouting. Not saying you won't find teal in deeper places, loafing or just hanging out, but blue wings especially, they'll be looking for that shallower, you know, 4 to 6 inch water level with food in it, because, you know, they're migrating through quick, so they're going to be looking for carbs to replenish that energy and get on their way.
Yeah, carbs and, you know, just down here, not to give away all my tips, but I think I wrote an article years ago about it, so I give away. They'll eat a snail pretty fast, y'all.
Yeah.
They like it. They like a snail. I mean, we all think about the invertebrates that ducks eat, but dang blue-winged teal, if your metal boat is scraping across snails on grass when you're going in a spot, that's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. Coming right back, more of our conversation about migratory birds and upcoming season. And we'll continue that with Cole when we come back. Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. By the way, to promote here, we're talking about in a few weeks, September 11th, 12th, and 13th, GND Farms Outdoor Expo.
Be a great time at the fairground.
Yep, we'll see you out there. And I know I got Midday Mobile. My show on Friday is going to be from there. And then you and I are going to do outdoor show from the event on Saturday. So all that's coming up.
Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And then I'll do that show. And then I'll go dove hunting after we hang out there, because that'll be, for us in the South Zone, opening weekend of dove season. Talking to Cole Howard, Migratory Game Bird Coordinator with the State of Alabama. We are on the duck front now, so let's talk about teal here. And if somebody hasn't checked regs, if they have not gone to Outdoor Alabama, they better go check, because there have been some changes. Hey, Cole, you there? There you are.
Sorry about that.
No, I was just saying, you know, the changes, if people look, it's a shorter season this year for blue wings. We got the 8-day versus the, right? We used to have, up to this last year, which was the year before, we went to the, I mean, you got two weekends basically, right?
Yeah, it should be, it's 9 days.
9 days, I'm sorry,
that's
9 days.
That's the federal framework.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got, and that's the 12th it opens, right? September 12th.
Yep.
Now, this is what all biologists want to hear. Let's do this. Let's split the state like it used to be in North and South, and y'all can have folks on the Tennessee River. I like those folks up there. They can start the 12th, and let us start the next weekend.
Yep.
He loves to hear this.
Yeah.
Can we?
Yeah, I think.
We're a long state, Cole. I mean, what's happening?
We are a long state.
You know, what happens in the Mobile Tensaw Delta, the stuff gets here a little bit later than it does on the Tennessee River.
A little bit. I think simplifying our seasons and making it easier for our hunters is one thing we're always interested in.
Yeah. Quit with all that. Dang it. I know.
Just change the date.
Cole's not in charge of this, but I want him to feel welcome. Everybody who's been in your role in the past has had to hear this from me, so this is your initiation.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
And teal numbers wise, you feel, I mean, we talked a little bit off there. You're feeling now. We'll do a later show when all the BPOP stuff is in, and but you're feeling pretty decent about the flight, the numbers this year.
Yeah, I mean, based on some of the preliminary stuff that has come out of some of the northern states breeding surveys, like teal numbers are looking pretty good. I know Minnesota had a really, based on their breeding population survey, had some strong numbers this year. Some of the overall Michigan numbers were up. Hearing from some of our Canadian Wildlife Service counterparts, they got some later rains in the summer that should have produced some really good brood rearing habitat, and they're feeling pretty good about things. So all in all, yeah, I think it's going to be a pretty good teal season. We'll see if the birds cooperate.
Let's look further on too towards what I call big duck season, regular duck season. And I you're a biologist, not a meteorologist, but you know, you go on any chat page with right. us duck hunters, everybody's like, man, got El Nino. We got it, or super El Nino. Somebody said, I didn't know how it made it super, but you know, the Grande El Nino. The prediction is more water on the landscape. I mean, as a hunter, as a biologist, your opinions on that?
I mean, it's all going to depend on if it gets cold up north, snowy up north, it'll have a better shot of getting bigger pushes down this way.
Yeah, I mean, that's. Yeah, so I mean, but to the north of us, we got to get the snow, and not just people say, well, it's freezing cold up there. The ducks still didn't come, but it does seem like you said snow. That seems to be, you have to have a certain amount of snow for a certain amount of days, I guess, for us to get a real push.
Yeah, and just the birds need a reason to move. They're trying to conserve energy. Stay warm, stay fed, and make it back up to the breeding grounds. And so if there's not really a weather reason for them to move, you know, there's duck migrations, that's a whole can of worms that could get into on like a 20 series talk about, you know, some birds seem to migrate off a photo period.
Yeah, calendar ducks versus cold front ducks, right? Yes.
And that's something that is still not fully understood, you know, why some species or why even some ducks in the same species, you know, exhibit these different migration strategies. But I'll say for us at the end of kind of the flyway, you know, colder weather and some, you know, nastier weather up north is always going to be good for us.
Yeah, I wonder how much of it, too, is localized. I think about some of the cold, you know, I think the last 2 years we had a pretty good cold outbreak. In January, right? Pretty good cold front.
Yeah.
And then snow for us down here, the big snowstorm. I mean, it wasn't the whole state, but we had a big snowstorm. You know, how much, obviously, we're watching the skies for migrating birds coming in.
Uh-huh.
But I wonder how much when it gets cold, too, those ducks that could just loaf all day here and then feed at night or whatever, mm-hmm. they get up and move. It's not even like sometimes that we got new ducks. It's just the ducks we have are having to move around more to get fed. Is there any science to that, or is that just me being an old duck hunter?
Yeah, there's, yes, 100%. So a lot of times when ducks get down here on the breeding or the wintering grounds, they kind of exhibit this like central foraging pattern. So they'll get to a place that's kind of like a home base for them where they're safe and they can loaf. And they can spend their time there. And then they'll kind of, from there, you know, bounce back and forth between sites that they're going to feed. And so, you know, when we get these cold snaps in the winter, especially when the ducks, a lot of our ducks really, they've shown up by January. Maybe some are coming in mid to late January, but the vast majority of our ducks are coming down by January. And so then they're going to sit there and loaf. And ducks are actually really boring in the winter. If you get curious, go read a lot of, there's a lot of great transmitter studies that have come out in the last 5 years of wintering waterfowl on like mallards and other species. They're actually incredibly boring in the winter. They'll loaf.
They sure excite me. They excite me, but yeah, their daily pattern is.
They They excite me too. Yes, their daily pattern, they really don't move a whole lot. And so when we have these big cold snaps, they're more likely to go feed at times when we can harvest them. And so there's just a higher probability that the ducks will be flying around, moving around, looking for food. They also might exhibit a little bit more risky behavior, going and checking out an area that might not be as safe to them, or they'll be investigating out new areas. Same way when there's like a flush of water on the landscape and there's some newly flooded areas that, you know, they'll go check out and see if there's any food there. And that's often a great time to have a harvest opportunity.
You know, you mentioned about when they get here, and that is, you talk about, we'll do a multi-part series. I have to get you back on soon because I love this discussion. You know, we used to think, and I hunt here and I hunt up in the Mississippi Delta as well. I used to think, all right, we're continuing to get pushes of birds. But yeah, that information, the studies that come out of Cohen and all those people showing that you pretty much, and it sounds like what some of the old timers used to tell me up there, that by the end of December here, you got the ducks you're going to have. And that, it just blew my mind. So mm-hmm. I kept thinking, we're always going to get another push. But the science is showing that, right? That they kind of, you got what you got.
For the most part, yeah. I was in Brad Cohen's lab for my master's.
Oh, wow.
I got to see a lot of those studies as well. Those weren't mine directly. I did my master's research on wood ducks in the Mississippi and Atlantic Flyway. But, yeah, I got to spend a lot of time with Brad and his students, which are awesome. But, yeah, exactly like you said, a lot of times, you know, these ducks are showing up. They're finding a safe spot. They know where, you know, they're figuring it out. But then again, they will move around on the landscape, and there are plenty of, obviously we're still harvesting lots of ducks, so they're moving around, there's harvest opportunities, but weather can definitely have a big influence, you know, pre and post front of how they're moving around locally on the landscape.
Okay, you just mentioned a duck, and here we got 2 minutes left, but I'll ask you here as we wrap up, the Alabama Mallard. Yeah. What some people call gray duck or gabble, yeah. But no, the wood duck. How's our population looking? I mean, we've been at three for quite a while here on harvest. Are they holding up?
Yeah, they're holding up. They're doing real well. Like I said, I've done a fair amount of research on wood ducks for a lot of my schooling. Here in Alabama, you know, we put out a lot of bans on wood ducks. Our guys are catching a lot of wood ducks this year so far, so I'm feeling pretty good about what our population of wood ducks is going to be sitting at this winter. Our harvest rates are very sustainable at this point. We're one state, you know, with all our rivers, beaver swamps, backwaters. You know, that is one thing we don't have a shortage of is wood ducks.
That's for sure. That'll hold us through.
Good news.
Yeah, and, you know, fortunately for me and unfortunately for them, it's for duck is my favorite duck to eat. I was about to say waterfowl. Speckled belly is my favorite waterfowl, but wood duck is, that's my favorite. Mike's looking at me. I love them. Cole, thank you for your time. Thanks for being on with us, and you have to come back on again.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
All right, there he is, Cole Howard, Migratory Game Bird Coordinator for the state of Alabama. And we'll be doing it again next week. See you then.